This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ronan Farrow has had a remarkable year of reporting. He won a Pulitzer Prize last month, shared with the New York Times, for his articles in the New Yorker about allegations that Harvey Weinstein sexually assaulted actresses. In another article, he reported on how Weinstein used an Israeli private intelligence firm to compile dossiers and track women and journalists to try to suppress or discredit the allegations. Farrow reported on how the same Israeli company that helped Weinstein also collected information on Obama administration officials who worked on the Iran nuclear agreement, looking for ways to discredit them. This month, Farrow broke a story about Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, and his suspicious financial activity. Also this month, Farrow, along with the New Yorker's Jane Mayer, broke the story of four women who accused New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman of non-consensual physical violence. Schneiderman resigned within 3 hours of the story's publication. Farrow also has just published a new book called War on Peace: The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. Farrow has a remarkable personal story, too. He's the son of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen. He grew up with 13 siblings. Many of them had disabilities and were adopted from other countries. He started college at the age of 11 and went to Yale Law School at 16. By the age of 20, he was working for Richard Holbrooke in the Obama State Department. Our interview was recorded last Tuesday and originally broadcast Wednesday. On Friday, Harvey Weinstein was arrested in New York on charges of rape, committing a criminal sex act, sexual abuse, and sexual misconduct. Ronan Farrow, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on this remarkable year of reporting that you've had.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's good to be here.
Well, Ronan, this year you shared a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting on Harvey Weinstein's sexual harassment and sexual assault of actresses. You shared the prize with Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey of The Times. How did you first get onto the story?
I had been an investigative reporter and an anchor at MSNBC and NBC News for a number of years, and had been trying to break stories that kind of spoke truth to power, much in the way the Weinstein story ultimately did. For my Today Show series, which was called Undercovered, meaning stories that don't get enough coverage, I would go after, the Department of Energy for suppressing evidence of deaths and illnesses at a particular nuclear waste storage plant. I'd look at miscarriages of justice in proceedings around sexual violence on campus or overprescription at VA hospitals, sort of classic investigative stories. And in the course of that series, I had fought for a green light on a series about the dark side of Hollywood. And there were a number of topics that kind of got the axe early on because they were deemed too dark. Things like, pedophilia in Hollywood and race in Hollywood. And that's, I don't say that in an accusatory way. That's kind of the game when you are in network television. It's a very commercial setting and you have to play ball. And there are these conversations all the time about what gets the green light and what doesn't. But I did retain a green light on a story about sexual harassment and casting couch culture, and had done a number of interviews with actresses that were not about Harvey Weinstein. And in the course of that reporting, then began hearing stories about Weinstein. And that story very quickly went from being a survey piece about the issue broadly to a realization that this was an incredibly important and long-suppressed set of truths, and that there were potentially patterns of behavior that could endanger people in an ongoing way. And so it went from, an initial actress on the record talking about this to a group of women talking about this on the record to very early on in the process, I got a recording of Harvey Weinstein admitting to an assault, which had been made in the course of an NYPD sting operation, and the evidence became too great to stop reporting.
Do you think that women were trusting of you in part because they knew about your sister Dylan, who had written about being sexually abused by your father Woody Allen, and you wrote about Dylan too, so they had reason to believe that you would be sensitive to and understanding about the situation and also the risks of going public? because you knew firsthand how you could be attacked when you go public, how you could be disbelieved and the more powerful person wins.
You'd have to ask those brave sources. You know, they had to relive what for many of them was the worst moment of a lifetime. You're exactly right. They had to stare down the prospect of a career annihilation and terrible smears, and as it turns out, physical intimidation, because Weinstein was hiring some very unsavory characters, as I was able to reveal later in my series of stories on him. You'd have to get their rendering of how significant it was, but I can tell you that it did come up in some of the early conversations, and I don't think, you know, any biographical background would be a panacea in this case. You know, these are incredibly tough decisions, and no matter how sensitive a person is, it's a leap that not everyone is going to make. And after months of conversation, some of the sources I was working with didn't decide to make the leap, and I always respected that. But for those who did this very brave thing, for some of them anyway, I do think they were aware that I had a public track record of reporting on this issue and talking about the importance of hearing survivors, and had seen my sister be smeared terribly for doing that, but also had put myself in the line of fire after many years of reluctance to talk about it because I had, you know, reviewed the evidence in my sister's case and concluded that when I was asked about this, I didn't really have an ethical choice in the matter. I had to say that I found it credible. And you know, that all went into sort of a soup of motivations for why I had spent several years banging my head against the wall reporting on this issue. And I can only hope that that created and continues to create a safe space for sources who have an important story to tell and need a reporter who's going to be careful in telling them.
One of the stories you wrote was about how Harvey Weinstein hired an Israeli private intelligence firm called Black Cube to uncover information that would smear the women who were going forward about how Weinstein had sexually harassed or assaulted them and therefore cast doubt on their accusations. And some people in this Israeli private intelligence firm were former Mossad agents, the Israeli intelligence agency. Was Black Cube trying to smear you as well?
Yes, and that's something that I already, you know, reported when we went public with the Black Cube story. They were, through that firm and an array of other firms that Harvey Weinstein had retained, aggressively going after both women with allegations and also reporters working on the story, both in an effort to smear us and also in an effort apparently to uncover sources, so that presumably they could in turn go after them. And, you know, these were elite, operatives with combat experience in a number of cases, using false identities and front companies. This was a very, very elaborate, almost cloak and dagger operation.
And they had people posing as reporters going to the women.
That was also a component of their work. And, you know, this continues to be a facet of the system employed by powerful people hoping to distort the news cycle. You know, I reported just in the last few weeks that Black Cube was also involved in an apparent effort to undermine the credibility of Obama-era officials who were involved in brokering the Iran deal. These sort of mild-mannered foreign policy figures getting, you know, sexual blackmail material dug up on them and having people with false identities reach out under false pretenses to their family members even. This is a system that is still very much intact and is very relevant not only to these important stories about sexual violence but also to our political future. You know, if you're wealthy enough and well-connected enough and you want to work in the shadows to either suppress the truth or manipulate events, you can still do that in this world today.
How did Black Cube, the Israeli private intelligence company, or anyone else on behalf of Harvey Weinstein target you and try to either smear you or suppress your reporting?
I've talked a little bit about the broad strokes of that, Terry, and I think I'm going to leave it at the broad strokes for now, both because of ongoing potential legal proceedings, and also because that's a subject for another book.
Okay.
But I will say, broadly speaking, this is something that should not happen, that reporters working on a story are threatened and intimidated and smeared. And it happens more than you would think. And in that sense, you know, you're not wrong to ask the question, and the public is right to want to know those details.
And you're right to write a book about it. I look forward to reading it. In the meantime, did Harvey Weinstein threaten you personally?
Yes.
Can you tell us what he said?
No.
Okay. Will you tell us in the future?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
You in particular, Terry.
Okay. So you grew up in a family that was in the tabloids, or at least I'm sure the tabloids wanted your family to be in it, because your mother, Mia Farrow, was famous. She was partners with Woody Allen. She had been married to Frank Sinatra. She adopted many children from African and Asian countries who had, you know, cognitive or physical disabilities. So tabloids love that kind of stuff. Did you have to defend yourselves against the tabloids when you were growing up? Did your family have to do that?
Very much so. You know, the media was a very intrusive presence in my childhood, and there were periods where I would be, you know, rammed through crowds of paparazzi to get to school, and you know, we had the media hovering, and literally hovering in helicopters sometimes, but also you know, as it turns out, private investigators hired by a wealthy guy, Woody Allen, you know, digging through our trash, trying to smear the family, call my mother crazy, call the kind of family that we had, you know, crazy or not a family. You know, defend the fact that he had had sexual relations with several of my sisters by saying, you know, it was a commune of adopted people and that doesn't really count. Was always the suggestion, continues to be his suggestion. So yeah, you know, look, this was a painful and tumultuous childhood in many ways, but I also feel very fortunate. You know, I was raised with an extraordinary sense of public service by a strong, working single mom who withstood all of that and was incredibly principled about standing by her kids and defending them. And probably to the extent that I'm not totally insufferable, Terry, it's because, you know, I wasn't a New York or LA kid for most of my childhood. I was, you know, sort of sequestered in the Connecticut countryside on a farm with a lot of chickens, which helps keep perspective, I think.
So when you were young, traveling with your mother to developing countries in Africa and going to villages where there was a lot of, like, illness and poverty, what was it like for you at a young age to be witnessing some of the worst hands that life could deal?
In a sense, it started even earlier than that, Terry, because, as you mentioned before, many of my siblings, you know, the people I love and care about most in life, were adopted from around the world with severe disabilities and were a living example of some of the worst hands you can be dealt in life. And I was tremendously inspired by just seeing some of my brothers and sisters get through the day. And it also made it pretty difficult to ignore the world's problems or get too wrapped up in your own BS, because you're always conscious of a bit of perspective, not as much as I should be, but maybe more than I would have been otherwise. And then, of course, you know, being in places, you know, as I then started doing my own advocacy work, and then subsequently when I was in government, where you'd be confronted with some of those incredibly difficult stories firsthand, it felt like the most natural response to try to tell those stories to the world.
You went to college at how old?
11.
And that wasn't just like a college course while you were in junior high or high school. That was like you went to college.
That was college.
How does that even happen?
This is where I really, like, ruin my reputation, Terry. Just descend deep into nerdiness. I had been doing a program that Johns Hopkins offers, which is a wonderful program. It's embarrassingly called the Center for Talented Youth, but we'll move on from that quickly. And it's sort of, you know, this X-Men style, you know, you get recruited and you go take college courses in the summer. And I had just been bored with grade school work, and they had already kind of been skipping me grades, and I would do these programs over the summer. And the way you get into that program is you take the SAT as a kid. So I took the SAT at, you know, something like 8 or 9 and got the kind of score where people said, oh, you should just go to college, and I did.
It's interesting that you are so achievement-oriented. You know, in a family where so many of your siblings who were adopted had some kind of physical or developmental issue that they faced.
Yes. I mean, I imagine there is a link between those two things, and probably a better psychologist than I could, you know, ferret that out. I did feel that there was very little space for me to act out in any way, right? Because my mom was shouldering such a huge burden, and she was a single mom, and it was so all-consuming taking care of my siblings, and I admired that so much that I just kind of wanted to lighten the load in any way that I could, and it therefore felt, A, I guess, very clear to me that if I had been dealt a hand where I could do these things in terms of academic achievement and maybe use that to engineer a set of skills that could be of some use to the world, that I had to act on that because not everyone had that opportunity, right, in my own family. But then also I probably wanted to lighten the burden for my mom in some sense, you know, and I was one child out of many who could excel in those ways. And, you know, if I'm being totally honest and scrutinizing myself, I wanted to succeed more as a result.
You got a bone injury when you were in Sudan. Was this working with the State Department, or was this traveling with your mother?
This was during the period where I was volunteering for UNICEF.
I see. Okay.
But it extended over, these complications were something like 4 years, where mm-hmm. I was sort of in and out of crutches and wheelchairs, and it extended right through portions of my time in law school, and then actually even my first months at the State Department, I was still on crutches.
How did it affect you to be unable to walk for the better part of 4 years?
It was a huge formative influence, Terry. And, you know, I'm cautious not to overplay this because I'm also very fortunate to be, you know, not struggling with disability right now. But it did give me a very acute awareness of just how quickly one's passport into the world of the healthy and the living and the fully mobile can be revoked, and how precious and tenuous this all is. And it makes me very grateful every day just to be able to get through the day.
During the math, it seems that it was around the year 16 to 20.
Yeah. So, right in the windows where what you want most desperately is just to fit in and, you know, date and dance and be human. And when one is grappling with severe illness, you know, life-threatening at various points for me, the last thing you feel is fully human. And I drew strength from my siblings who had more permanent disabilities than I, and from every person I have met since grappling with this sort of a situation.
So you realize that the passport to health and to, you know, a quote, normal life could be revoked at any moment. You also learn that a successful career could be revoked at any moment as well. Mm-hmm. You had been an anchor at MSNBC. You had your own afternoon show. Mm-hmm. That ended. And then you were continuing to report for NBC. But maybe as a result of the Harvey Weinstein reporting you wanted to do, that they were not anxious to have you pursue, that job ended, but you were kind of out in the cold for a while.
Yes, that's right. There was a low point last year where I did not know if I would have a job in journalism in a matter of weeks or indeed ever again, and was being told by some very powerful people that I would never work again, and, you know, also being told by some pretty sensible sounding people around me, you've got to just let this go, just let it go, and your career will be fine, and if you don't, it's all over. And yeah, that
when you say
the reality
let this go,
is
you mean the Harvey Weinstein story,
the Harvey Weinstein reporting. I had been ordered to stop reporting and cancel interviews, and I didn't.
And then you landed at The New Yorker.
Yes, and it really felt like a miracle, because I had spent a long time in rooms with executives being told that this wasn't a story. And then, as you pointed out, coming face to face with the very real possibility that it might be the end of my career that I continued to pursue the story. And then to have The New Yorker step in and, first of all, commit to reporting this, and just seeing them have the reaction that every journalist who had looked at this body of evidence from the beginning had, which was, this is an incredibly important, huge story, all hands on deck, let's get this publishable as quickly as possible. But then also on a personal level, being yanked back from the jaws of career decimation meant a lot to me personally, and I'll forever be grateful to this incredible team at The New Yorker. I mean, The New Yorker is like a magical fairy tale place journalism-wise. Every single person at every echelon of management there is a true journalist, and they stick up for dangerous and difficult stories. And, you know, after being completely exposed to legal and physical intimidation and threats, to suddenly have a team around me saying, "We'll stand by you," was really important. It restored my faith in our profession, honestly.
Well, Ronan Farrow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. Great to be here.
Ronan Farrow is a contributing writer for The New Yorker and author of the new book, War on Peace: The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. Our interview was originally broadcast Wednesday. On Friday, Harvey Weinstein was arrested on several charges, including rape and sexual abuse. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Courtney Barnett's new album, Tell Me How You Really Feel. Barnett is a 30-year-old singer-songwriter from Australia who received rave reviews for her 2015 debut album, Sometimes I Sit and Think, and Sometimes I Just Sit. Ken says the new album fulfills the promise of her debut.
On her debut album a couple of years ago, Courtney Barnett presented herself as the sort of withdrawn artistic type who sits in a corner at a party, alternately shy or making savage jokes about the guests. On her new album, Tell Me How You Really Feel, there's an implicit acknowledgement that her new popularity has necessitated a more public life. And on a song called Help Yourself, Barnett is so good she can distill everything I just said to the five words that form this chorus. Humble but hungry, need validation.
Darkness depends on where you're standing. Jump the creek and watch the sunshine swim. You found in a pig.
As an out gay woman, Barnett has been outspoken on issues including marriage equality and domestic abuse. On the song Nameless, Faceless, she addresses male rage, picking up on this quote by the novelist Margaret Atwood. Men are scared that women will laugh at them. Women are scared that men will kill them. Barnett folds those words into this song, along with her own take on various manifestations of misogyny.
Thank you.
success of Barnett's debut album seems to have taken her aback somewhat. She feels some pressure. In recent interviews, she's admitted to writer's block during the composition of these new songs. That situation has inspired another of her trademark long song titles. This one is called Crippling Self-Doubt and a General Lack of Confidence. I hope she realizes she struck gold with that one because critics and other writers love self-punishing phrases like that. It helps, of course, that she's made good music out of those words. Crippling Self-Doubt and a General Lack of Confidence also features background vocals by Kim and Kelly Deal from the feminist American rock band The Breeders, an influence on Barnett.
Yeah, they say whoever pays, the piper calls the tune.
Did you notice Barnett's guitar playing there? She's really good in a forceful punk rock manner. It took me a few listens to another song called Charity to realize what it reminded me of, the way Lou Reed's records in the 1980s sounded. On Charity, she's got something of Reed's vocal phrasing and a bit of Robert Quine's slash and burn style with her guitar. The new songs sound like inner monologues shaped and sharpened for public consumption. Barnett undoubtedly wants her album title to be taken in two ways. Sincere interest, tell me how you really feel. And eye-rolling sarcasm, tell me how you really feel. It's not ambivalence, it's complexity. It's not self-absorption, it's articulating what's inside her, that she knows is also inside of you.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the album Tell Me How You Really Feel by the Australian singer-songwriter Courtney Barnett. Coming up, we'll hear from Kristen Ritter. She stars in the Netflix series Jessica Jones and played Jesse Pinkman's girlfriend on Breaking Bad. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Our guest, Kristen Ritter, is the star of the Netflix series Jessica Jones, which is based on a Marvel Comics character. Season 1 and 2 are on Netflix. The series was recently renewed for a third season. Jessica Jones is not your typical superhero in tights. She's a hard-drinking, low-rent private eye with superhuman strength. She's also coping with PTSD from two big traumas. She believes she's the sole survivor of a family car accident from when she was a child. She was also the sex slave of a supervillain named Kilgrave who could command people with his voice. As several reviewers have pointed out, the show's themes of sexual assault and female rage make Jessica Jones a strong feminist hero in this era of the Time's Up and Me Too movements. Kristen Ritter also played Jesse Pinkman's girlfriend in Breaking Bad. She spoke with our producer, Sam Brigger. They started with a scene from Jessica Jones, in which Jessica is attending a court-mandated anger management session where she's supposed to tell the group how she's feeling.
My whole family was killed in a car accident. Someone did horrific experiments on me. I was abducted, raped, and forced to kill someone. And now some maniac says that I am here for a reason. Like some sick destiny. She's out killing people, and I'm in here bouncing a ball.
That's a scene from the second season of Jessica Jones. Kristen Ritter, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So the first season of Jessica Jones was about your character coping with the trauma of basically being a slave to the supervillain named Kilgrave. His superpowers, like commanding people with his voice. And he rapes her and also has her kill someone. And in the second season, the character seems to have moved from a stage of trauma into some situation where she's feeling a lot of rage.
Yeah, Jessica is really struggling when we find her in the top of season two. She hates herself. She doesn't know if she did the right thing or if she's actually a cold-blooded killer. She was capable of murder. It was easy for her to do that. So she's dealing with a lot of conflict with that. You know, the public, her friends all say, like, you did the right thing. We can sleep at night knowing that that guy's out of the picture. But Jessica is very fearful that she is a monster. So that's kind of where we find her, just really, really battling with that.
And it seems like one of the questions the season is trying to figure out is how can Jessica harness that rage in a positive way and not be so destructive to herself and the people around her.
Sure. And a lot of the thing with the season, you know, we deal with her rage and she's wondering, like, how far that is going to take her. Where is the line? She finds herself constantly stepping over the line. And then when the opposing force, Jessica's antagonist, shows up and ends up being basically a souped-up version of her, her mother, who is a rage monster and can kill people without remorse, without any awareness. Jessica is terrified that that is where she's headed, playing with the themes like, you know, relatable themes like, am I my mother? Am I becoming my mother in this elevated superhero way where if she becomes like her mother, there are major consequences.
So this season, you get to play a younger version of Jessica Jones. I think it's like episode 7 or 8 where
yeah.
There's a lot of flashbacks to a younger version of yourself. And there's also a lot of scenes in this season where you're alone and there's not a lot of dialogue and you're just sort of emoting, you know? And
you're
very good at that. Like you, I don't know if you have a very expressive face or you're just good at expressing yourself. But I'm just wondering, like, technically, what goes through your mind when you're doing those scenes? Like, are you like, what level are you working at? Are you being like, okay, scowl, okay, scowl some more? Or are you thinking about like your life, or are you thinking about the character's life? Like, I'm sure all those levels could work, but where do you do it?
I am doing the most work when I'm saying lines. It's just been ingrained in me. If you don't have anything going on in your head, you're not interesting to watch. So I would say that the bulk and the majority of my work is when I have no lines. And I love it when I have no lines, because then often, like, I'll talk to Melissa about a scene. I'm like, I would love the opportunity to have this play on my face. Could we cut XYZ lines? And we usually do. It's exhausting because you have all of that, like all of my subtext, all of the history is there. Yeah, you can't just, like, stand there and scowl. That's not going to register. That's not going to affect anybody. That's not going to hit heartstrings. You got to feel it if you want your audience to be in it with you. So I just make sure that I feel it, and I have a ton going on.
You also were really terrific in the second season of Breaking Bad, and you played Jane, who was a recovering drug addict, who eventually starts using again when she dates Jesse Pinkman. I wanted to play a scene from that show. Your dad, played by John DeLancey, has just found out that you're using again, is obviously really upset. And we'll also hear Aaron Paul, who plays Jesse, in this clip.
You're going back to rehab today, now.
Look, as it so happens, we were just talking about that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I was going to tell you, okay, if you would just let me.
18 months. You have been clean for 18 months, Jane. Why? Why do you do it?
I backslid, okay? Like, what? What, you think I'm proud of this? Like, I do it on purpose?
Lying to me. Shacking up and using with this scumbag, this loser.
Hey, it takes one to know one.
His name is Jesse, Dad, and you don't know the first thing about him. We talk about rehab every night. It's his idea.
You talk about rehab? Well, geez, isn't that wonderful?
Thank you for not being judgmental 24 hours a day. Because that's exactly what I need, to be judged all the time.
You know what you need? I'll tell you exactly what you need.
Well, what are you doing? What are you doing?
I am calling the police.
Dad! Dad, hey, no! Don't!
Come on! Dad, come on!
Dad, no, don't!
I have tried 10 years of love and understanding. Sir? Maybe what it takes is you drying out in a jail cell.
Dad, no!
Yes, I would like to report drug use in a building that I own.
Dad!
No, it's ongoing.
Daddy, no!
It's illegal activity. I'd like to talk to somebody.
Daddy, no!
Would you connect me, please?
Fine, we'll go to rehab.
I could care less about him going to rehab. I want you in rehab.
Okay, I'll go first thing tomorrow.
Not tomorrow, today.
I have to call into work. I have to stop the newspaper. Last time I went to rehab, all my houseplants died because you didn't water them, so... Daddy, please. I'll go.
Albuquerque police, how am I direct your call?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
I don't know. I just think if we had enough money, nobody could make us do anything.
That's my guest, Kristen Ritter, in a scene from Breaking Bad. It's a really powerful scene, and it's very emotional. How do you prepare when things are going to get that emotional?
Oh, my God. Even hearing that, I was like, whoa. Because it's so sad, because we know she doesn't go tomorrow.
Right. Is that a scene that you would work on a lot together?
That's a scene I think that we would mark and have a good shape. I think with something that emotional, because that does get pretty heavy, mm-hmm. you don't want to totally take the air out of the tires. Of course, like you end up shooting a lot and you shoot different angles, but that wouldn't be a scene that I would want to go to 100 in rehearsals.
Right.
With stuff like that, like and in Jessica Jones too, there are some heavy scenes where it gets like, you know, really hardcore and really emotional, and I would kind of have a good idea what I wanted to do. I will kind of go to the sound department first. And kind of tell them, like, hey, just so you know, like, this is what I'm planning to do. I'll talk to the camera operators, to the DP, like, and the director, of course. This is kind of like, I'm going to mark it for you, but, like, I just want everybody to be ready. Like, you never want to do, like, some crazy performance where you get really emotional and then, like, your mic blows out because they aren't expecting, like, a huge volume.
Right.
So I tend to, like, have a really good idea or a really good sense of what I'm going to do. And kind of show a shape, and then go for it.
Later that episode, you have a really violent death, and you know you're passed out on heroin, and you start choking on your own vomit. And Bryan Cranston's character, Walter White, is there, and it looks like he's about to help you, but then he decides just to sit there and watch you. You know, you're convulsing and you're spitting up, and he just lets you die because you've gotten in the way between him and his partner Jesse. It's a really horrible scene. Was it a hard scene for you?
Yeah. I think the harder scene for me was when I was actually dead the following episode. It was emotional witnessing someone grieving for your death. And I'm a very sensitive person, and Aaron Paul was really just, his performance was so amazing, and he was so distraught and so devastated and crying and on my chest and him and trying to revive me so violently that it was intense. I tried to like go in my body so much, but then he couldn't help but think like, oh my God, if I were dead, like someone would be doing this. It was hardcore. Those are the moments where you're like, man, acting is really weird. Additionally, there was a body cast made, which was, thank God, they had the foresight to do that. It was like cast, it screwed together on the sides to protect my chest so that Aaron could really go to town. But they made it for my body double, and she was a little bit more petite than I am. So the thing didn't fit all the way. So he's like smashing on my chest, and each time it wouldn't latch, so it was pinching my skin every time, and I'm just trying so hard to like lay there and be dead, and I couldn't get a full breath of air because of it. We had to take a minute. It was really, you know, when you're on the verge of like of anything emotional happening to then like pound on your chest is just going to come out.
Yeah. You were at a mall with your mom and were approached by a talent scout who asked if you had ever considered a career in modeling. Is that something you jumped at? Were you suspicious of the scout? I mean, it sounds like something from a movie, too.
Totally. Well, it was a woman, and she was...
That probably makes a difference.
Yeah, yeah. And she was from Elite Model Management, and that's a reputable agency. Even I had heard of that in the back of, like, 17 magazines. We were surprised around that time. So I would have been 15 when I was scouted. My mom was, I guess, pregnant with my sister, and a lot of the nurses would always say, like, oh, Kristen's so tall, and, oh, she should be a model. But that thing that, like, people just say. But it wasn't like I was, like, pretty in high school or, like, had that kind of, like, I don't know, vibe. So when I was scouted, it was pretty surprising. And my grandmother said something to me. She passed away years ago, and she said to me, she was like, modeling was the best thing that happened to you because I saw what it did for your confidence. And so I'm really grateful for that.
So you started modeling at 15, and you were doing that in New York and Philadelphia, and it moved to New York at the age of 18. And you did fashion, you know, all over the world.
Yeah.
Eventually, modeling led to work and acting. And is that something you took to right away?
Yes. Because I think, you know, like I was saying before, I didn't really know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I'm modeling, and I'm angsty, and I got my guitar on my back, and I'm like, I want to be a rock star. And I didn't like how I was treated at my go-sees. I would try to crack jokes. They weren't really interested. It was just like the kind of cliche fashion industry stuff.
Right.
And so when I started getting sent on commercials, they were like, tell us about yourself. Tell us a funny joke. Do a funny dance. And I'm like, okay, I could do all of those things. So that I got the bug kind of right away. I started booking all the commercials. And then I was like, I can always be better. I can always work harder. I can always show up earlier. I had a science to arrival. I wrote it down in my journal. Like, this is what time you need to arrive for an appointment. You don't want to be 20 minutes early because then, like, you might annoy people. They're not ready for you. But you don't want to be 5 minutes early because what if you have to use the ladies' room or what if you'll be rushed? So I decided that arriving, like, 12 minutes before your appointment was, like, the best. And this was, like, something I came up with at, like, age 20. My science to arrival. And I still use it to this day.
That's great. Well, you've branched out from acting. You last year wrote a novel called Bonfire.
Yeah.
A thriller. And you said you wrote the book in response to some disappointing roles you were being offered at the time. And this was in between, I think, the seasons of Jessica Jones. What were some of those roles?
Honestly, like, Jessica's a tough act to follow. Mm. Jessica, like, the work that I get to do and the backstory and the character building and, like, just the breaking down the scripts, and I'm just so invested and I really get to sink my teeth into it. And so then when you see a part where, I don't know, it's like a group of six girls going to Vegas and, you know, the girl is like, oh my God, you're so getting laid tonight. Like, I can't do it.
Yeah.
I can't do it, and I don't want to. And I just felt like there, in that time, especially, you know, end of 2015, it just felt like all of the comedies that I was seeing featuring women were all raunchy, sexy, and drunk. And I'm like, I just don't believe that that is the only source of comedy that you can get with female characters. And so I didn't really want to participate in any of them. I felt like I would rather sit out, work on my side hustles. I think my time is going to be better spent generating my own stuff, telling stories I want to tell, being really, you know, being excited. You know, being on set and, like, working is hard work. And when you love it, you never want the day to end. But it takes you away from your personal life. It takes you away from your house. Like, it, you know, it puts strains on all of your personal relationships. So it's got to be really, really good and really worth it.
Kristen Ritter, thanks so much for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me. What a great interview. I appreciate it so much.
Kristen Ritter stars in Jessica Jones, which has been renewed for a third season. Seasons 1 and 2 are on Netflix. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger.